Hotter Than Ever is brought to you by Broad Collective, a membership network for professional women pivoting to self-employment in midlife. Maybe you've been dreaming of starting your own business, or you already work for yourself. In Broad Collective, you'll find the strategy, peer support, tools, and practical resources you need to take ownership over your career, connect with your target audience, scale your business, and grow your income doing the work you love. Creating meaningful content is the best way to get the word out about who you are and what you do. But most solopreneurs don't have a strategy for how to use social media, AI, podcasting, newsletters, self-publishing, public speaking, and all the other media channels available to us today to make the biggest possible impact. In Broad Collective, our members learn from each other and from experts how to turn their expertise into revenue and how to do it joyfully by leaning into our strengths. Whether you're an established entrepreneur or just starting out, as a Broad Collective member, you don't have to grow it alone. Go to broadcollective.com for more information and apply today. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, where we uncover the unconscious rules we've been following, we break those rules, and we find a new path to being freer, happier, sexier, and more self-expressed. I'm your host, Erin Keating. Today, I talk to Eve Rodsky about the gendered division of labor. That sounds really academic, but it is not. It exists in your own life. Her book, Fair Play, was an absolute phenomenon because it both diagnosed the problem of the disproportional amount of domestic labor that women are saddled with in marriage and motherhood, and it proposes a practical, now not easy, but practical solution to making that labor more fair. We talk about how men and women's time is valued differently, how a domestic task is more than just its execution. You know this. It's its conception and planning and execution, like planning the meal, the grocery shopping, and the cooking, also the cleaning up. There's a lot of parts to these things that seem like one task. So if your partner says, well, I do the cooking, do they also do the planning and the grocery shopping and the cleanup? They probably don't, but they want the cash and prizes for being a good partner for doing one part of the task. And the rest of it, sadly, often falls to us. We talk about how male and female brains are in fact not wired differently for taking care of home and hearth, contrary to popular belief. I have been fired up since this conversation, and I've been talking to everyone who will listen about Eve's work because it was a revelation to me, and it really answered some mysteries I had about why I always felt so burnt out juggling work and domestic life and motherhood when I was married. I cannot wait to hear what you think of this conversation. Take a listen. Eve Rodsky's New York Times bestselling book and Reese's book club pick, Fair Play, is a gamified life management system that helps partners rebalance their domestic workload around unpaid labor and care, which in an ideal world will help them reimagine their relationships and stop women feeling so under the gun and men feeling nagged so that we can all be happy in our domestic lives. In her second book, Find Your Unicorn Space, she explores the cross-section between the science of creativity, productivity, and resilience to help women find space to do the things that light them up. I love this so much. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, Eve.
Oh, hi, Erin. With you, I do feel hotter than ever, so I'm very happy to be here.
I'm glad to hear that. So you were infamous in my household before I ever heard of Fair Play, before I ever met you. I heard, and my husband heard, maybe on NPR one day, this, what became a meme in my marriage, which is the phrase, I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries.
Yes.
And that was something that your husband had texted to you.
Correct.
My now ex-husband and I.
Congratulations.
Thanks so much. It was necessary. Partially because of some of the stuff you talk about in your mm-hmm. book. We parsed the shit out of this. Because the phrase, I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries, is so loaded with domestic responsibility, assumptions, entitlement, just, wow. I mean, we really would like say it to each other and then laugh, but it didn't help us solve the domestic labor issues in our marriage. And I'd love to hear the origin story of sort of what became this phenomenon that you created called Fair Play.
By the way, Erin, a lot of people end up in the same boat. And I think what happens is that, and we'll talk about how powerful tools can be, but once those assumptions, expectations, patterns are almost too deep,
yep.
You know, sometimes it's just easier to reset equality by separating households.
Yeah.
And so we actually have a lot of people in the Fair Play movement and the Fair Play system who use Fair Play as a co-parenting tool because they don't want to, you know, have anybody think, as one woman said to me, Fair Play taught her that she didn't have a magical vagina that whispered in her ear what her husband's mother wanted for Christmas. Sometimes the assumption of the magical vagina is just it's too strong, it's too deep, mm-hmm. and you got to get out. So I like to say, if any woman says that they are divorced, we know that over close to 80% of women are the ones initiating divorces in America. So congratulations to you.
Thank you. And I will follow up with you about the follow-up book about how to do fair play divorce and co-parenting, because I don't think it would work in my co-parenting either.
Yes. Yeah. Well, again, that's why you're out. And we could absolutely talk about what we've seen in terms of those patterns. It can be dire out there. So we'll go dark to go light. So as the origin story for me, and as my son, Ben, my middle one, who's 12, he likes to like monitor the Fair Play like universe. He's like, Mom, there's this Google question always like, is Eve Rutsky still married?
I was just going to say that when I searched.
Yes, yes.
I wanted to dig into the actual game, the deck of cards that you created around this that we will get to in this conversation. But when I Googled that, first question Google suggested is Eve Rutsky still married?
I know. My son told me that. The truth is that, as Seth says to people now about our relationship, you know, how did you come so far? His recommendation to men is that they should have their wife write a book about them that betrays them in a terrible light. But the truth is that we've come really far, but this has been the ultimate centering practice of my life. And that practice has been this idea of moving Erin from what we call an organizational management. And I'm a lawyer by trade. We look a lot at bias, how you end bias. And really the only way to do that is from moving from assumptions to structured decision-making, right? Mm-hmm. Investing in that structured decision-making. And so Seth and I, that has become the practice of our lives. But it did start, the origin story, as you said, I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries, but I wanted for your listeners to help us picture the scene. So I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries text happened as I was racing to go get my older son, who was 3 at the time, from his toddler transition program, which in America, they last like 5 minutes and we have no universal healthcare. And so, I mean, universal daycare. So, you know, things are hard for childcare when your kids are young. So I was racing to get my son. I had a breast pump and diaper bag in the passenger seat of my car. Mm-hmm. I remember having like gifts to return in the back seat of the car. I had a client contract in my lap. I would say like the pen was sort of stabbing me in the vagina when I would hit like a stop sign. And that was because I'd started my own law firm at the time, right after my second son, Ben, was born, because my corporate career had imploded based on my expectation and asking to work one day from home. I started to get penalized just by asking for that on maternity leave. My direct reports were taken away from me. So I was going to be coming back into a very hostile environment. So I was being abandoned by my workplace. At the same time, I was being abandoned by my partner and his expectations that I was the fulfiller of his smoothie needs. And on top of it, at that toddler transition program, which, by the way, in America, everyone told me that once my kids got to school, things would be easier and that I would, you know, have a new community of people to help me. So I get there, you know, to this toddler transition program just around the same time that I'm getting the blueberries text and the same time that my workplace is abandoning me. And this preschool teacher echoes that these are going to be my new support system, the people around us, you know, because it's the beginning of a toddler transition goes all the way to sixth grade. And the preschool teacher, Erin, says to me, these are the people that are going to know you better than anyone's ever known you. And I looked down at the name tag she gave me and it said Zach's mom, Zachary's mom.
Oh, so you're erased. They're going to know you, right? But they're going to know your role and that's it.
Right. So the people who are going to know me better than anyone's ever known me in this new phase of my life don't even know my fucking name. Oof. So how can you be hotter than ever when you're erased, right?
You cannot.
You can't. So that is where this started for me. And I think it was this, because this is 2011, 2012, I didn't have an Erin. I didn't have podcasts. I didn't have social media. I didn't know that this was a phenomenon. All I had was literally a library, really, of resources that I ended up going to. But at that time, no one was talking about these issues. And in fact, it was incredibly shaming to say anything negative, and still is, you know, about a male partner, right? Because we have such low expectations of men. Like, he doesn't abuse you, you know, that's great, you know? But we have such low expectations that the idea, it was this idea that I would tell people the story about Seth sending me that text outside of a whisper was very like provocative for a lot of people.
It's remarkable how much we, as working women who work our whole lives to get our careers going, and then we go, oh, fuck, I gotta have kids. You know, and hopefully you've found a partner, or you go out looking for a partner to have kids with. And then this whole boulder of social expectations, of domestic responsibility. I mean, I was a New York City professional woman with capers and champagne in my refrigerator.
Yes,
like
yes.
I was out every night. I was living my life. I was anti-domesticity. And when I had my twins, my entire life shifted and turned upside down. And I still insisted, you know what? No, I've worked this whole life to get all of these things. These are the things I want. And I should be able to do all of this because this is what's modeled for me. Like in the culture, there's this sort of two income, sophisticated, urbane, two parent couple.
Both of you can wear your carrier and just take the kids to France on a moment's notice.
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And I couldn't wait to go back to work from maternity leave because I was so overwhelmed.
Same.
I threw money at childcare. I had to have a 50-hour-a-week nanny from minute one. And I don't remember the first year of my kids' life. I really don't, because my maternity leave was 10 weeks, which is, you know, and 7 of those weeks were paid. And there were 30 people in line for my job. If I stepped one step to the right, I would have fallen off the career ladder altogether.
Absolutely.
Why is, I mean, obviously, patriarchy, misogyny, sexism, the culture not catching up with women in the workplace, the economy conspiring to make us, you know, be driven by materialism and keeping up with the Joneses and all of these things. But I didn't feel like I had a choice not to go back to work. I didn't want that choice. I wanted everything. And the cost of everything was way too fucking much.
Well, I think that's beautifully said. Preach. I think that alone, if you're here listening, if you take nothing else away from this conversation, it's what Erin just said. You're not alone. Mm. Private lives are public issues, Erin. Mm. And unfortunately, as you said earlier, capitalist patriarchy, which is what we live in, has to convince us that they're private lives. Because if we organize and believe it's public issues, then things will change. And that is ultimately what fair play became. What fair play became was an understanding that there is a way to take agency in your own home while we're waiting for these other things to change. You know, we can fight for paid leave and better childcare at the same time as we breathe polluted air. We don't want to not breathe. You still have to breathe that polluted air, breathe. But I felt like there was a better way. But I had to go through sort of hell to find that way. And my first hell was understanding that this wasn't a me problem, Erin, that it wasn't my fault that I couldn't do it all, like you said, that I was collapsing in my marriage and not blaming myself. And I'd say, you know, a story that I tell in the book that was really illuminating about this was that I was on this breast cancer march one morning, it was Saturday morning, I talk about this, and I was with women like you, Erin. And I, at that time, this is right around the blueberries text. And I'm not sure I would have even been aware of these issues if I hadn't had the blueberries breakdown. So I feel very happy that Seth sent me that text because it changed my entire life, obviously. But at that time, I didn't know it changed my life. I just knew that I had this riff with Seth over his assumptions of me being his fulfiller of his smoothie needs. And then I was with women that we didn't talk about these issues. What Erin just said was something that remained unsaid, even though I'm sure we were all feeling it. Right. So I go on this breast cancer march. It's a Saturday morning. We all have young kids. We're honoring a friend who was recently diagnosed. We're in pink glitter, you know, like pants and carrying signs. This is a Saturday morning, you know, not just a women's problem, courage, strength, and power, whatever our sign said.
Right.
We had like Sharpie on our hands from making signs in the morning. I don't know. It felt like a girlfriend's getaway, even though it was only a Saturday morning. Right. But the thing I noticed was that at noon, we became Cinderella, or like the reverse of Cinderella, right? We sort of all turned into pumpkins because we weren't all married to men, but the women, especially married to men. And that's what we're centering today, because that's where all these assumptions and problems happen. Even if you're not married to a man, they will affect you in your pay gap. What these women were doing, when I was like, why is everyone like all of a sudden quiet and looking down at their phones? Mm. And I noticed that of 10 of us, we were getting texts. And they were similar to my texts, Erin. I had a friend, you know, whose husband was sending her, "Where did you put Hudson's soccer bag? And I can't take him if you don't tell me where his equipment is." I had another friend say, like, her partner said, "What's the address of the birthday party? You know, if you don't give me the address, like, did you leave me a gift? Should I be going to this party in the first place?" Another funny text was like, "When are you coming home from the parade?" You know, with like this porn voice. Mm-hmm. The parade. And then my favorite was my friend Kate's husband, who texted her, "Do the kids need to eat lunch?" Mm-hmm. And
probably
what was so sad, though, about that day was that instead of us all being like, "Fuck that, we're going to lunch, we're turning off our phones," which I do think, because again, we have people like you out there as cultural warriors, we have fair play, we have new vernacular to talk about these issues. I do think there is change. But in 2012, when this happened, every single one of these women looked at me and said, "I can't believe I left my partner with this much to do." Mm. And they left me there, Erin. They left me to go find Hudson's soccer bag, to pack, you know, perfectly wrapped gift, you know, to a birthday party, to make their kids lunch.
I literally could burst into tears, Eve. Like,
I felt that way.
The constraints of a working mom's life are so intense. And this learned helplessness on the part of our partners, which like partially their fault, partially not, is so oppressive. Like, no wonder women feel like they're a husk of themselves when they're trying to do everything, when it is not possible to do all the things that you need to do in all of these roles and maintain a sense of self.
No. And in fact, I want to just take it down a step further. So when that first act of resistance happened for me that day, was I actually forced those women to count up how many phone calls and texts we had received. So we had 30 phone calls and 46 texts for 10 women over 30 minutes. Now, why that's significant is because it started to lead me down a journey of understanding that exactly what you said, that this is unsustainable. This is unsustainable. I was not going to live this way, right? It was going to be probably an eat, pray, love narrative at that point. Like, get me the fuck out of here. But what was fascinating was that what it did was it pushed me into the library. And I think it's important to understand that this phenomenon that we're talking about, Erin, has a name. In fact, on average, women do shoulder 2/3 or more of what it takes to run a home and family, regardless of whether we work outside the home. And what was fascinating about digging deep into the research on the gendered division of labor, which I didn't know I'd become an expert at. That was not in my third grade, "What do you want to be when you grow up" board, Erin.
Yeah.
But I am an expert at the gendered division of labor now. And what I found, or what we know, is that it's a gender issue, as you said. It's not a monetary issue. A lot of people, when I was fascinated by this issue and wanted to really work on it, said to me, "Well, once women gain economic power, which is happening, this is all going to go away, right? Because then they have to have equal partnerships." Well, the good news and the bad news is that it actually doesn't disappear.
No.
Women who make more money than their partners and have active careers actually do more unpaid labor. That's how we know it's a gender issue. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So I want you to validate that because I think a lot of people don't understand how they get into those dynamics. How can I be the breadwinner and also being the one knowing the name of my child's dentist? But that is a phenomenon called the second shift. It's called emotional labor. It's called the mental load. And my favorite term, Erin, and I'm doing this with you because I've heard you speak, and you do go granular and deep, which I love about your conversations, and you're so smart. But there was an article written in 1986 by a sociologist named Arlene Kaplan Daniels, and it was called Invisible Work. Mm-hmm. So of all the terms, mental load, emotional labor, second shift, I actually really liked invisible work the most, because what she was arguing in 1986 was that we have to keep home siloed. We can never, patriarchy can never allow women to complain about their husbands with each other. Because if we start to realize that this is a breast cancer march issue, that women are getting 30 phone calls and 46 texts for 10, you know, for 10 women over 30 minutes, that they're going to want compensation for this work. Mm-hmm. And so society has to keep it invisible. Otherwise, we're going to start demanding, you know, wages for housework and things like paid leave and, you know,
we're going to blow this shit up is what we're going to do.
We're going to blow the shit up like we did in World War II, mm-hmm. by the way. In World War II, there were universal daycare centers to allow women to be active in the workplace. Right. And that's expensive. And we were going to require it again. And society is afraid of that. So that was a really interesting premise. And actually, that sort of set me on the fair play journey, because I really wanted to, in a naive way, but it led to fair play. So I'm glad I started this way. I thought that I could enumerate the invisible and make it visible. And that's where I started. That I thought, okay, well, if it's invisible work, it's going to be provocative just to ask women all over this country of all socioeconomic status, you know, statuses, what
is that
do you do
right.
that you're doing for your, in service of your family that may be invisible to your partner that takes you more than 2 minutes. And that's how the Fair Play Project began in 2012, asking women like you, what do you do in service of your family? And by the way, I asked this on TSA lines. I asked this to like people literally in the middle of Costco. I asked it everywhere I could go. I had a pen and paper and a moleskin asking this question. And over a year, I got an answer.
Thank God for your obsession. Thank God for you being so smart and so curious and driven about this topic. Because when I was reading your book and I heard about all the things that started flooding in, and then the way that you codified it, categorized it, and then broke it down into holistic tasks, not just, we can get into the granular, not just execution, but the, what is it, CPE?
The conception and planning of that task, which is ultimately, it takes a lot more hours than the actual execution of any task.
Which we all know because we have fucking jobs.
Yes, we have jobs. We have, and by the way, planning whatever thing you're good, like, I don't know. I saw Elon Musk has a new car out. He didn't just execute. That didn't just go into a factory line.
No,
I'm sure that they conceive of it and plan it. We understand in the workplace that tasks just don't, we don't want helpers. Erin, even my Aunt Marion's Mahjong group has more clearly defined expectations in the home, right? You don't bring snack twice to that group. You're out.
Yeah.
But the home, we're deciding who's taking the dog out every night, right when it's about to take a piss on the rug. Like, what happened to all of us?
Well, I mean, I think it's the silence, right? The conspiracy of silence around all of this stuff. Yes. And you write about this too, but I had this deep experience of like, don't talk about your children at work.
Yes.
Do not talk about your job when you're picking your kids up from preschool. I always felt like such an alien because I felt like, wait, I am more identified with my work life than I am with like being a mommy. And I didn't have fucking mommy group time. I was a career person. Yeah. Like I didn't get the mommy and me memo. I also had twins.
And so by the way, you wouldn't have wanted it. You wouldn't have wanted it. I did three of those groups, and every one of them, it was about what diaper bag to buy and like whether or not to breastfeed.
Google it.
Was really not, it was not a helpful reframe, Erin, in any way, shape, or form.
But I wanted community. I wanted peers. I wanted people to be able to talk about this stuff with. And I just felt very much like I do not get to keep the thing that I've built in my professional life if I ever make excuses for not being available because I have kids. Like, I really felt the burden of my own complicity, my own silence in the workplace. Even though I work with a bunch of other moms, we secretly were like, oh, it's your kid's birthday. You know, congratulations. But you know what I mean? It was like,
absolutely.
The men could talk about their kids all they wanted.
Because so can I tell you a little bit about that?
Please.
The paradigm, what you just said, I think is so important. It becomes part of a movement. There was a father, there is a father who practiced fair play. And this sort of gives you a sense of what fair play is for your listeners, as you know, as like a 101 primer. But there was a man named Ed, and his wife is Julie. And they came to me as beta testers in 2018. This is before Fair Play came out in 2019. But I had been about 5-6 years into interviewing and testing the Fair Play system, which ultimately came out of the research of that invisible, what do you do that takes more than 2 minutes, which became a should I do spreadsheet, that became an Excel sheet that of 98 tabs that took me a year to make. And that 100 tabs, when you realize lists alone don't work, you have to really either make systems or just resign yourself to doing it all, or as Erin chose, which is a great choice too, just to leave that relationship. So Ed was someone who's helping me to beta test the system. Julie is someone who, under the metaphor of fair play, there's 100 cards that it takes to run a home and family. There's 60 cards if you don't have kids. You add 40 additional cards that each have a monetary and time expense if you have children. So that's part of the problem, right? The work just gets so much grindier and more difficult. So they were holding about 88 cards, because some of the cards, you know, you can throw out of your deck. Thank God. Some of them are wild cards, like the death of a family member or dealing with sick in-laws. But they held about 88 cards in their family. And Julie told me she held them all. She had a part-time job. She held every single card. And that goes from everything from making school lunches to transporting kids to being tooth fairy and on and on. So that's the 100 cards.
But she just has a part-time job. She should be able to handle that.
Exactly. Ed, yes, was the CFO of a major institution. They start to play fair play. The only thing that Julie feels entitled to ask for, because her mom goes into hospice, is that she wants her partner to take on the homework card. So she's asking him to hold one card of the 88 cards at the time. She can't handle in the holidays her second son's second grade Secret Santa project, because it has to be done from scratch. And by the way, that's a part of the problem for why this becomes private and not public, is our communities shame us. So they do things. Teachers will say to you, they'll call parents first. The schools call us first as women. They make us do these homemade projects.
I always refused. I don't have time for that. Like, my daughter hated me for it, but it's like, I'm not that kind of mom. I just have to say that. I just would say to them, I'm not that kind of mom.
I'll give you support in other ways, right? Yeah. And Julie did care about this project. So I asked her to articulate why. So she tells me she cares about this project because two things. Her son Brody's really popular. The second grade Secret Santa project he drew was a little girl that was new to the school, and this was already December, and she would sort of line up and no one greeted her. Mm. So she sort of sat there with her backpack, and she felt like, my son's popular. What if he like does a welcome to the school project for her to make her feel like a valued part of the community? And also she said, like, all he was obsessed with Nerf guns. And she's like, I want him to understand that there can be some beauty in doing projects from scratch. Like, mm-hmm. you can be excited about something that somebody makes homemade for you. So she tells this to Ed. I force her to tell her why to Ed instead of all the reasons why he can't do this project. He does step up. He ends up seeing the beauty of owning this task with his son. I know it sounds so small, and we're like, come on, Ed, you could do more. But that's where they were in their relationship. Yeah. He takes on this one task. He tells me that he conceives of the project, ownership mindset, which is what Fair Play is about for homework for this assignment. And he Googles second grade Secret Santa projects with his son, Brody. They decide to focus on the Popsicle stick jewelry box. And his son, Brody, wants a knob so that the girl didn't need two hands to open the top of the jewelry box. I love that Ed's giving me that detail. They go to a store. He tells me there's this really cool store called Michael's.
Oh, he's heard of it.
And you can find everything there. I'm like, awesome. I'll check that store out. And then they start to build the box together. What Julie tells me about this sort of fair play journey was that it was sort of the first time ever in their marriage that she had ever seen Ed on the floor with her kids. Mm. And it also was really transformative to her because out of the corner of her eye, she noticed that he had glitter all over his hands. And she said the metaphor of this glitter was the first time she felt like he was truly in this relationship with her. And what's been interesting about starting with glitter, starting with something so small, is that a lot of times we go policy first. When ultimately, sometimes we have to go empathy first. And what's been interesting about Ed, this is a long story to tell you, that he helped me formulate exactly what you said earlier about the workplace. He felt, because he knows I like my alliterations, that we could put in for what's happening in workplaces. And by the way, his institution was one of the only ones that said hybrid in his field. So I wanted to say, I'm not saying that's because of the popsicle stick jewelry box in 2018, but I will say he's actually really evolved as a father. And he told me that he feels like all the problems could be related to fair play, meaning men are not allowed to step into their full power in their home so that women can step into their full power in the workplace. Like that, that we're not, men are not holding popsicle stick jewelry box cards or homework cards. They are relying on their off-screen women counterparts to do that. And he said, so that's fair play. He said, but there's also fair day, which is that he felt in his industry that the idea, this is before COVID, but now it's past COVID, even during and past COVID, that the people like him are trying to bring people back 5 days a week, that they are not giving people a fair day. They don't want flexibility for their employees. They're monitoring them on this weird software. You have to raise your hand to take a piss like in Shawshank Redemption. So that's fair day. Then he also said there's a fair say issue. Because the people in leadership are really white men with stay-at-home wives. That's the 1% in this country. And then there's a fair pay issue,
right?
Which is that we're never going to get to equity because women have this motherhood penalty. So I do like that paradigm, Erin, if we're moving forward, that it's fair play, but it's also fair day, fair say, and fair pay.
I love all of it. I love also your hybrid word, she-fault, the she-fault setting. Is that she does it.
That's
how it goes. I think one thing that I struggle with time. Time has been a thing that I've always struggled with. I think the origin of it is that I grew up in like a custody family where I had no control over my time. As a kid, I felt trapped on the weekends.
Trapped.
And so as an adult, I have been like just a maniac about controlling my time. And then when you have kids, your time is 100%
hijacked,
prescribed,
prescribed.
And one thing you talk about is that men's time is seen to be finite. There's only so many hours in the day, and women's time is seen to be infinite. Well, she can do; she can just add another test or
find time. List. Yep,
I'll find time to do it. And at what cost? And so, what do we do about that? I love the principle that all time is created equal. There is an underlying assumption that women have some kind of magical capacity for the minutiae of domestic life, the being able to remember, you know, that so-and-so's mom's name is whatever, and that you have the contacts in your phone, but your partner doesn't have the contacts in their phone. Oh, can you send me so-and-so's, what's her name again? It's, you know, and it's like, I've sent it to you six times. Like, why do I have to repeat that labor all the time? What is so devalued about my minutes in contrast to yours?
Well, I think that if you look at really what fair play evolved into. It evolved into one question that I asked Erin that was really getting my ass in gear and becoming my own client. Because my day job, I came at this from a different perspective. I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a lawyer.
Right.
And I look at the world through behavior design lens. Because really, if you want to change anybody's behavior in America, it's through our legal system, right? You want people to stop at a stop sign, guess what you're going to do? You're going to pass a law.
Yeah.
Want people not to vote in Georgia, you're going to use the court system. You want to restrict people's reproductive rights, guess where you're going? You're going to the courts.
You're going to Alabama.
So,
yeah.
Right? You're going to Alabama. So I came at this looking at this as a behavior design issue. Of course, we know that this has been entrenched and designed a certain way to to benefit a certain amount of people. But I figured, what if I could give people the tools to treat their home as an organization? Mm. That, as a lawyer, I thought I could design a system for people so that they're not waiting to take the dog out every single night when it's about to take a piss on the rug. But that assumption was for men who already believed that their partner's time was valuable. Mm. So what I realized was that a healthy organization needs three things. Boundaries, systems, and communication are really the three things you need. I could design a system for you that's similar to the workplace, which ultimately fair play is. It's 100 cards. If you have somebody who believes your time already is finite like theirs, you could go in and you could start straight with the system to make your life more efficient. However, Erin, the majority of women married to men in America that I was able to survey through a whole year of 2012 were not even willing to come to the table about these issues because they said to me four things. And I want to repeat these four things because I think they're very important. Because if you've said it to yourself, it's totally fine. I said it to myself. It's a practice. It is conditioning. But these are four non-truths. They are toxic time messages that allow our time to be hijacked. So what women said to me, one was, of course, I'm the one picking up the kids from school, making the dentist appointments, being the tooth fairy, because my husband makes more money than me. That was very common. He makes my life, as opposed to looking at it as you make his life and you're taking all the risks because they get to leave with a job and marketable skills if they want to get out of this relationship and you have a lot less power. Yep. Women said that was number one. Number two toxic message was my job is more flexible, so I can handle it. I can find time. The problem with that one is that there is a study that shows when women are doctors and men are lawyers, they say their time is more valuable when they switch it and the women are the lawyers, the men are the doctors. Guess what, Erin? Ta-da, you know, women's time is more, you know, they have more flexibility. So we can't use that. The third was in the time it takes me to tell him, her, they what to do, I just have to do it myself. Oof. It's easier to do it myself. That's familiar. And it's also just a present value risk because you're devaluing future time by handling it in the present. Of course, you don't want to keep doing it yourself because that means your time is hijacked.
Right.
The hardest one for me to handle, though, was that I said this to myself all the time. I'm somehow wired differently to notice things and for care because I was the one who did notice when my son had a cut that looked like it was getting red on his leg. And I was the one who noticed that we were out of toilet paper. And so I thought that there really was a gender difference in how we multitask.
Me too. I believe that about my ex.
And by the way, one of the hardest days in my research cycle over the past 10 years, Erin, was sitting down with a top neuroscientist who answered my questions very frankly when I said, you know, are women better multitaskers? Because I'd asked other neuroscientists, but he said it in such a beautiful and striking way that it really stopped me in my tracks. The first question he asked me is, he said, are you asking that from a cultural perspective or a brain science perspective? Mm. And I said, well, I'm coming to you as a neuroscientist, so duh, brain science. And he said, there is no gendered difference in how people task switch. But if you ask me culturally, does it make sense for me to convince you that you're better at wiping asses and doing dishes and for you to take pride in that by saying, I'm a better multitasker? Of course it does, because Eve, as a man, I get to have tenure, I get to have a golf game, and you take pride in it. So it's a great situation for men if we believe and we convince you that you're better multitaskers. So he was joking, but he said, do I really want to be part of a book that debunks the myth that women are not better multitaskers?
Me? Right.
It benefits me. That I really, really was hurt that day, Erin. It was very, very painful.
But it's fucking true. It's like, why would they be complicit in dismantling the system that benefits them disproportionately?
Right.
Like, oh, because they love us? Yeah, maybe. Like, that's what we can hope, right? They love us. They want to stay married. They want to raise healthy, happy children. They want to set a model for the future and empower their kids to, you know, to live the lives they want and not feel oppressed and trapped and like prisoners of their household routine. But that,
by the way, that was Ed, though. I will say the evolution I've seen in this man in terms of the amount of unpaid labor
aka cards that he started to hold, understanding that his partner's time is just 24 hours in a day. Mm-hmm. When I asked him, what were the most revelatory things that really got you thinking differently? There were two things. One was conception, planning, and execution. He just literally had no idea that a task wasn't just if you tell me what to do, I'll help. He didn't understand, as a CFO, he's telling me,
in the domestic
thought it through, right, that there was an ownership issues in the home. Okay, right. Fine.
Maybe.
That was number one. Fine. CPE was helpful for him when it was all broken out. But the bigger issue was this reframe. Oh my God, time is not money. Time is 24 hours. Like, my partner, regardless of how much money she makes, should get equal time choice to me over how she chooses to use her day. He was willing to accept that he was wrong thinking of time as money. I think, again, this is why it's a movement. It's going to be hard to push, and it has been hard. It's been 10 years of work to continue to push this narrative that an hour holding a child's hand in the pediatrician's office is just as valuable for men as an hour in the boardroom. But Erin, it is a movement.
Yeah.
And we need more people like Ed. And it takes literally, that's why, like a politician, I go corn fair by corn fair. I go house by house, because I feel like that's how you have to do this work. You have to go vote by vote, and you just convince voters one at a time. You knock on their doors, metaphorically, physically, and you keep reminding people time equality was missing in the feminist movement, and we have to bring it back.
But time is money, Eve. Time is money. That might as well be written on our money. To fight, God, I'm feeling this in so many of the conversations that I'm having on this podcast, which, like, when you say I'm a culture warrior, I'm like, I am? What the fuck?
Yeah, you are.
Oof, that's a lot. You bear a lot on your shoulders by taking on this advocacy work, but you're trained as an advocate, and now you've seen an injustice and you can't fucking unsee it. Like, I keep seeing women like you who are fighting the good fight day in and day out for various parts of our agency and our ability to make the decisions with freedom in our lives that we want to make. Full stop. How do we use our time on planet Earth in this very short life that we get? We should have much more say over that than we do. And one thing I want to talk about is this notion of unicorn space, because I really related to this part of the book. And also now that you've written a second book about it, this idea, like when my kids were 5 and 6 and 7, this was like the heaviest part of my parenting journey, my marriage. I had the biggest job I'd ever had. I was working 1 billion hours a week. I had a full-time nanny, but that doesn't really help with everything. If she could help with certain things and not with other things. My kids stayed alive and they ate food and they got to school and they came back and some things were clean when I got home. But like everything else was on me. And I was infinitely stressed out. I was crying on the weekends. My husband was accusing me of being a workaholic, but not stepping up to the table around sharing domestic responsibility. Even though at one point I'm going to just tell tales out of school right now. Even though at one point he told me that he felt like a 1950s housewife because was working so much. And I'm like, God. So the 1950s housewife that doesn't go grocery shopping, that never cleaned anything, that has a full-time nanny, like, what the fuck are you fucking talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the level of entitlement there and the level of like, this is on you, girl, that I felt, I was so boring in every area of my life other than my professional life, which I over-prioritized and hid inside of because it made me feel like myself. I was so boring. I didn't have interests. I didn't have hobbies. I didn't have anything except for parenting, domestic responsibilities, work, and work responsibilities. I barely had a marriage. We barely had a relationship. And I literally thought I was going to die. And then I got COVID and I almost died. And it's not a coincidence. And you talk about how this stuff transmutes into ailments.
Yes. Well, you are our demographic.
Oof.
You are our demographic. Women, we've been following women like you who in 2012 told us that they shouldered more than 66 of the 100 fair play cards. And they also work for pay. And Aaron, as you said, what we're seeing 10 years later is not, it's not, this is not optional, what we're talking about, yeah. because it will come to get you.
Yeah.
And every single one of these women, there's 200 of them that we were able to follow up with. Every one of them, Aaron, is being treated for stress-related illness. If they haven't worked on these issues of redistricting the fairness or even leaving their relationships, if they're still in that same situation, we have 100% of those women who tell us that they are being treated for stress-related illness. Now, let me tell you the order. Number one is SSRI use, of course, right? Right. This idea that let's get you on Lexapro or Zoloft. Number two was hair loss. And then number three was autoimmune. So Hashimoto's and other versions of lupus, yeah. a lot of scary autoimmune stuff happening out there. And then four, we're seeing sort of this bizarre cancer diagnoses. And we're not saying this is a correlation yet. We're seeing just the causations, and we're working on some real new qualitative and quantitative research with USC at the moment. But we do know for sure that women are twice as likely to get diagnosed for an anxiety disorder. What's happening that Aaron's talking about, that feeling of death, we saw it in a word cloud where we started to survey women in our Fair Play world. And there was a word cloud of many emotions of how you feel during your day. And there was two that popped out in this giant word cloud, if you've ever used like a word cloud software. And that was overwhelm and boredom. Oof. So that to me is really the place that if you get to, as you said, it may mean you have to exit your relationship. Fair Play is not going to be a tool.
Yeah.
Probably at that point. But what's interesting about those two words is that typically when you see overwhelm, there's excitement with the overwhelm. I'm so overwhelmed. Like a book's coming out. I'm starting this podcast. Like there's so much to do. Boredom, you think of as your teenagers. Like it was so fun to be bored. You're just sort of sitting around the house. But when you have overwhelm and boredom as a combination, that's a deadly combination metaphorically and actually physically. And as you said, with your COVID example, the only answer out of that is unicorn space. It's such an important concept that I decided to write a whole second book about it. And it wasn't because I felt like I was a unique expert on burnout, Erin.
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. We live on burnout.
But
that's our thing. But it became such a big part of this discussion because it became a way back to those boundaries we were talking about earlier. That of course, Fair Play is a system. You see the cards, you can get shit off your plate. But for women who were not or couldn't feel like they could ask for a fair division of labor, we found a different entry point. We found that people were automatically going to lifestyle changes in their home. Again, in your case, it was divorce. Other people's cases, it was their partner stepping up like Ed to do more domestic labor.
Love you, Ed.
Yes. But to get there, the why was missing. And so when we gave people back their why, Aaron, it was so empowering and exciting. And their why wasn't, there's a happiness trio that helps us with our dopamine. Adult friendships and self-care, not commodified wellness like getting your hair dyed, but like, you know, going on a walk with your dog. Those two are important for sure, but that's almost like the baseline. Mm-hmm. The entry point to actually getting women to move out of their guilt and shame, out of this idea that they can never be unavailable for being a parent, a partner, and a professional, was this idea of unicorn space. It's a third thing. It's not a girl's trip. It's not self-care, even though those are important too. Mm-hmm. It is a cycle of being curious, connected to others, and completing something. Once we saw that cycle, we saw dopamine responses that women were willing to step up and say, I want more of this. So I'll give you an example. Yes, I know this is part of tied to your professional career, but your podcast, for example, is a unicorn space.
Yes.
Because you get curious about something that's related to your values.
Yes.
You get to pick who you want to interview. Then the next step is you have to connect with those people.
That's right.
You have to reach out and say, I'm going to, you know, throw my shot and see if this person is going to come on my podcast. You have to then connect in a different way. You have to connect with your listeners.
Yep.
You have to actually share yourself with the world, which is scary as shit.
Yeah.
And then you have to complete something, producing it and getting it out into the world for other people to judge.
Yep.
Though that cycle, as scary as it is and why a lot of us don't pursue unicorn space, is because it is hard to be curious. That's led by our values. Yep. It's hard to connect and share yourself with others. And it's hard to complete things. We can become a graveyard of unfulfilled dreams, as my friend called herself. Oof. That cycle is very, very important, Erin. And I call it unicorn space because the space to live in curiosity, connection, and completion that is based on your individual values doesn't fucking exist.
No, I had to blow everything up to get it.
It's a unicorn because it's a magical being.
And not look for a job when I got laid off and decide to take the financial risk and take the emotional risk and just be like, I do not know what the fuck I'm doing. Yes. And I know what I know. I know what I know how to do. But this just felt so non-negotiable to me because I was living without it for so long. I was like, so thirsty in the desert, you know? And now I'm just like, gimme, 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 gimme. Let's have these conversations. Let's get into it. Let's engage because life is short and we suffer a lot, you know?
So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I think another big part of this conversation really has to be on how toxic the conversations about what women want has become. We have become obsessed with this idea of happiness. There are podcasts on it. Even the people who have these happiness podcasts say that their work has been hijacked. Positive psychology has become toxic. This idea that we always have to be happy. And really what has happened is that instead of dealing with the issues of unpaid labor and pain and overwhelm and everything we're talking about today, women have been told now we should just gratitude journal ourselves to death. So I'll tell you how that comes up. I have like a lot of, you know, people out there looking at things for me, and everybody now will screenshot a post that they see on social media where a woman says, I'm so happy I learned from blah, 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 toxic positivity, happiness person, scholar, that I don't say anymore, I have to, I say I get to, and my life has changed. So I don't have to take my kids to school. I get to take my kids to school.
You do have to. They have to go there.
Exactly. That is such a horrific message. I don't get to clean up fucking my child's vomit. I have to. Society has put me in a place where it's my responsibility and I have to. So these messages, I believe, have been really, 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 really harmful. So instead, what I try to do in Unicorn Space and in Fair Play, because I bring up these concepts in both books, is reframe what a true definition of mental health looks like. So I went to the best experts that I love, all those people I interviewed for Fair Play, and I went back to them to ask them, what is a true definition of mental health? This is what a true definition of mental health is consolidated. It's having an appropriate emotion at an appropriate time and yet having the ability and strength to weather it. That is mental health. So I'll give you an example. Yeah. Instead of thinking I have to be happy all the time, instead, what you're going to say is that in motherhood, especially if you have a partner who is not helping you, you're going to feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel anger. You're going to feel more than anger. You're going to feel fucking rage. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel resentment. And if you know that those are appropriate emotions and you're having them at appropriate times, how amazing is that? You are mentally healthy. You just have to know how to weather it.
You're just pissed.
Yes. Yes. But then all you have to know is that you are mentally healthy if you have the ability and strength to weather it. The problem comes with the ability and strength to weather it. If we don't have unicorn space and what you've decided to do and be courageous, and women who are telling me that they're trapeze artists and that they are unavailable on Sundays now for their entire family because they're working on their floral arranging.
Right.
If we don't have that.
Because men have golf.
Of course they do. Of course they guard their time.
Do whatever their unicorn space says to do. Like
what they always have, by the way.
Sure.
And by the way, golf is a great one because you get to be curious. Can I get the ball in a hole? You get to connect with others because you always play in groups and you have to complete 9 holes or 18 holes.
So very satisfying.
They've known.
Yeah.
They've known about unicorn space forever. What we have to realize is that because we have not been able to ask for what we need and accept what real mental health is, that we have appropriate emotions at appropriate times and we are mentally healthy, but we don't have the ability and strength to weather it. So what it looks like is hedonic well-being, meaning we start to numb ourselves through our lives. Why has mommy juice become an entire meat on every social media platform?
I call it the cult
right?
of Chardonnay. Yeah.
They call it because what else do we fucking have?
Edibles.
I'm edibles. Exactly.
Thank fucking God for edibles.
And that is what a lot of women, I won't say a majority, but we had a good minority telling me that they start taking edibles at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning and take them all the way through TGIM. Thank God it's Monday, all the way through Sunday night. I get it.
Right.
However,
fucked up long term life. Yeah.
Long term yeah. health will have us replacing these hedonic pursuits with unicorn space activities. Not saying you have to do either or, it could be a both and.
Both and.
But we add on curiosity, connection, and completion because I'm telling you, it's not optional. Mm-hmm. It is what will help you weather these hard times. And even when you don't wait, there's a whole generation of women that I interviewed who are in their 70s who said, I don't know what you're complaining about. Just wait till your kids grow up. We are not going to wait anymore till our kids grow up to claim what makes us interesting. I will not allow that to happen.
Wait 20 years of your most vital, energetic, socially connected, intellectually engaged time in your life? No. That shouldn't be the option. No, we have.
It was, though, I think, for a lot of people who are, again, CIYOO, complicit in their own oppression. How could we tell them there's a different way, right? Then they have to look back and say, I wasted these beautiful, viable years. Right. I will say that there was one woman I interviewed for my second book that was very honest about this, who said that she was very resentful of her children getting to do what they wanted to do. And she was in her 50s and she did feel like she wasted those viable years. But what's fascinating about this woman and why I interviewed her for the second book was she understood, because I said earlier, right, this is about curiosity, connection, and completion, but not curiosity like I wonder why my child's poop is yellow, which is one woman told me when I asked her what she's curious about. It's our values-led curiosity. Right. So again, I'm going to just give you values, Erin. I don't know you, you know, well, but I can tell that you're somebody who probably has values of justice and fairness and lifelong learning. I see that in you, yeah. Right? This woman said to me that her number one value, because she had been stuck so long in her house, was the need for speed. Mm. She didn't know how it was going to translate, but she just felt like she wanted to go fast somewhere. Mm. She was so slow and so methodical and so stuck.
That.
And so she ended up becoming a race car driver.
Fucking A.
And at 67, she's one of the most accomplished women in something called the Carrera Americana and all these races across countries. She's been to every continent, including a special car in Antarctica. And she is living her full power. And guess what? Her kids are so fucking proud of her, Erin.
I bet.
And her daughter is her manager. It is the coolest thing ever. We don't all have to be Renee and Christine, but we can have our own versions of that journey.
Yeah. Oh my God, Eva, love this conversation so much. I have been so angry since I started reading your book. And I have talked to several people about whether I should send it to my ex-husband and engage in a conversation about how he reacted to my request for more parity in domestic labor. And then everybody's answer is like, fuck it, you're out of there. You know,
you're out. What I wanted to say about that was part of, I think, the lean in feminism was so fucked because they had this message, like we have to choose these great equitable partners. But what people don't realize is that it changes. If someone had just told me that men do 5 to 15 hours a week less domestic labor once kids come, I think I would have felt validated, because that's the biggest problem, is that the person we marry is not the same person we marry once kids come.
No,
they're just
not
the same human.
We're not the same.
No.
We're different.
No.
And how do you predict whether you're going to evolve together well? You know, that's the billion-dollar idea.
Well, again, right? I think for what I've seen now, watching couples engage with this fair play movement, is that to me, the greatest predictor is that people are understanding that there's three words that are probably the most toxic words you can use in a relationship.
What are they?
And those words are, we're going to figure it out.
Oh, like it's an abstract, kick the can down the road.
Exactly. If I hear those words and people don't understand how toxic that is, we usually see the same assumption versus structured decision-making patterns. If people understand that figuring it out and kicking that can down the road actually just means that they end up recreating patterns of their childhood, right, or things they've seen on TV. That figuring it out actually, unfortunately, happens in really destructive ways unless you change that narrative for yourself. That is the biggest thing I can tell. Mm. And I can tell right away from how men engage with this subject, whether it's going to, you know, this conversation will help them or not. It's very interesting.
God,
it's called a saturation point, Erin. I've hit my saturation point.
I also love men. I just don't want them. I don't want to do domesticity with them. I just don't.
Please don't.
I just
please don't
do the fun parts. Like
fun parts is wonderful. Fun parts. Things are changing. And our generation, I'm hoping, has hit this last frontier of feminism. This idea that women have to step into their full power in the world, but we haven't invited men to step into their full power in the home, and that has not worked for us. Mm-hmm. I do feel like the tides are changing.
Oh, okay, good. I needed to hear that. Eve, I ask everyone who comes on this podcast one question, which is, are there any deal terms in your life today that you are ready to renegotiate? You're a lawyer. You get this talk. Or has this just been a constant stream of renegotiation for you?
Well, I love it so much that you asked that question. And it's one of the reasons why I felt like our work intersected, because literally the entire premise of Fair Play is the redeal. Mm. And so Seth and I renegotiate on a daily basis, where it's things like, I'm fucking done taking the kids to the dentist, Seth. I hate being there. It's in the basement. I don't have Wi-Fi. I'm stuck down there for an hour. I'm sick of hearing the sound of a drill. It's triggering. I can't deal with it anymore. It's time to redeal the dentist. So on a finite level, we have negotiations all the time. But I will say a deal term in all women's life that I'm starting to work on is this idea of figure it out at the family law level. I want women to understand that there is power in understanding their financial position related to unpaid labor once they enter a marriage. And so the renegotiation of the deal terms of marriage, whether it's through mandatory prenups or guides that I can offer women for all 50 states and what their, you know, state default laws look like, that is something I'm working on right now, actually. The renegotiation of family law and how much it discounts women's unpaid labor. So that's a big thing I'm working on right now.
Well, it's like a whole follow-up conversation.
Yes, yes. Let's do that once I've testified in a few more family law court cases, which I've been doing on Zoom, and it's been really interesting. But I seriously come back for that.
I want to hear about that, because I learned a lot about family law through my divorce.
Yes, yes,
and,
yes.
You don't think you have a prenup, but you do. It's in the laws of the state you live in. Exactly. If you bought the house, he gets half the house. That's my life today. And you know what? I'll take it. I'll take the freedom over anything. I'll take the freedom to live my life on my own terms over all the hardships, because we deserve it. We deserve it. And we settle for so much less, so much of the time. Eve, I'm so grateful for the work you do. I'm so moved
by the work you
do. You're amazing. Thank you for coming on. And I hope we get to do a follow-up soon.
And we are hotter than ever. And I love your premise. And thank you for, like I said, letting me put these values on you. But I see you as a cultural warrior, someone who fights for fairness, someone who articulates justice, someone who cares, as you said, about your freedom, and who's giving women permission to be unavailable from these really, really constraining roles. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hotter Than Ever. If you have been enjoying this podcast, please leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Your honest, heartfelt feedback means everything to me. And the more great reviews we have, the more people will be able to find this show. That apparently is how the Apple algorithm works. And who are we to fight the algorithm? Also, tell your friends about the show. That's how things catch fire. Have you been listening to our weekly advice episodes? Are there issues in your life you would like my very biased and unqualified feedback on? Just DM us on Instagram at HotterThanEverPod, or call and leave a voicemail, or even text your questions to the Hotter Than Ever Hottie hotline at 323-844-2303. The old school telephone number for the Hotter Than Ever Hottie hotline is 323-844-2303. I would love to answer your question in a future episode. Hotter Than Ever is produced by Erica Gerard and Podkit Productions. Our associate producer is Melody Carey. Music is by Chris Keating, with vocals by Isa Fernandez. Come back next week when the revelations will keep coming at you hard and fast.